Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, and thank you for joining today's teleconference. It's time to be appropriately cautious, but also opportunistic. Today's discussion may contain forward-looking statements. All statements made that are not historical facts are subject to a number of risks and uncertainties, and actual results may differ materially. Please refer to the ARS most recent outlook and the ARS website for important legal and disclosure information. With that, I'll turn the call over to Sean Lawless, partner at ARS. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Bernadette, and welcome everyone to the call. We're going to spend roughly the next 30 minutes or so to discuss some of the questions and concerns that we're hearing from you, our clients. So in the interest of time, let's kind of jump right into it here. I'm joined this afternoon by two partners here at the firm, Stephen Burke and Ross Taylor. And I'm going to start off with the first question for you, Stephen. One of the biggest concerns that we're hearing, not surprisingly, is about the ongoing trade war with China. Maybe if you could share some of our current thinking with regards to the situation.
Sure. Thanks, Sean. Well, let me start by saying nobody wins a trade war, especially one involving the world's two largest economies. Christine Lagarde, managing director of the International Monetary Fund, about 2 weeks ago said that the losers in this will be the U.S., China, and the rest of the world. The effects of this trade war are being felt worldwide, and it's coming across in a couple different areas. One is we've seen a slowing of global growth, and the IMF projects that if the current and proposed tariffs go on, stay on or put on, that it could take about $450 billion off of global GDP in 2020. The second area where we're seeing change going on is it's changing the terms of trade. How global supply chains operate require that there's a steady state for how the rules of the road are, and they're changing with these trade negotiations. And you've seen it in a couple different areas. I'll just highlight two examples of it, but it certainly slows down or makes uncertain the spending capabilities for companies. So the first area, last week Apple mentioned that it's considering moving 30% of its production out of China. If you take a manufacturing plant and relocate it, or production line and relocate it to another country, the chances of that coming back are not very good. Manufacturing loss typically doesn't return. This is a real warning shot across the bow for China, seeing that Apple is such a big part of their manufacturing system there and a headliner. The second thing came out today, and it was reported in the FT that Vietnam, country nearby, has seen its exports to the U.S. rise 40% in the first 4 months of this year. It gives you a sense of the changes that are going on around the world right now. That's important because as business spending drives is one of the big drivers for where capital flows, and these adjustments to the terms of trade and supply chains will have long ramifications years out. Another area that the trade negotiations are impacting us is both in monetary and fiscal policy, and it's across the board. China's been using fiscal and monetary stimulus, tax cuts, increased domestic spending, as well as rate cuts to stimulate its economy to try and maintain its reported growth rate of around 6.5%. Growth at that level is important for China to maintain both its trajectory, but also as full employment as they can get and social stability, two of the things that are paramount in their style of government to maintain. On the other hand, in the U.S., the Federal Reserve, after raising rates considerably in the second half of last year, and announcing plans to reduce their balance sheet, which has grown, would have grown by about $4 trillion, is now in the process of reversing those policies, putting rate cuts on hold, and also further reductions of the balance sheet on hold. And there's even a high view that there'll be rate cuts coming in July, and with more to come in the second half of the year. The 10-year Treasury is down over 1% off its high. Mortgage rates are down 0.5%. So not all this is bad because lending rates come down with it, but it also means that we're not seeing the type of growth that the world was looking for. Add to that that in Europe, Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, said he's going to continue its whatever it takes monetary policy, and that's led to global government bonds worldwide of seeing over $12.5 trillion now carrying negative yields. That negative yield is actually driving capital to the U.S. with our 10-year treasury at around 2%, which further puts downward pressure on our rates and attracts more capital here. So there are a lot of implications of the trade war that are playing out. So what happens now? After months of both sides taking very hard positions, a week ago, President Trump and President Xi agreed to meet at the G20 meeting coming up this weekend. So they're going to try and move discussions forward. But for that to happen, both sides will need to move off their hardline positions right now. And it's going to require that both of these strong leaders are going to have to give their negotiators permission to move off their current negotiating stance. So what could go wrong with this? Well, given the two personalities are involved, a lot could go wrong. Both President Xi and President Trump are very strong in their nature. While they advertise themselves to be good friends, their friendship will be tested over the next weekend. It'll be important that they set the right tone for negotiations to reopen. That's one of the things that could go wrong. Second thing that could go wrong is President Trump is in looking forward to the next election. If he doesn't believe he's being hard enough, or if the population doesn't believe he's being hard enough in the negotiating terms, that'll impact his re-election chances, something that is quite important to him. President Xi, on the other hand, for China, may believe it's better to wait till the 2020 election in the hopes of securing a more favorable deal. So that's important, too. What we actually expect will happen is trade negotiations will resume. The tariffs will either be postponed for a set period or indefinitely, probably more likely indefinitely. It gives us, the U.S., a little more flexibility. And that they'll work towards a resolution by the end of the year because it's in everyone's best interest.
Thanks, Stephen. Stephen, I'm going to stay with you for the next question as well because it's somewhat related. ARS has long talked about the U.S. being a standout global economy. Do you think that continues?
The short answer is yes, but let me start since we were just talking about the U.S. and China. It's fair to say what China's done since 1990 in terms of its economic development is nothing short of spectacular, and they deserve a lot of credit for their unique approach to socialist capitalism that's gotten them to move from around the 10th largest economy to the second largest economy in that time. But there are challenges that lie ahead there. And for us, the U.S., despite all its flaws, is the most dynamic and resilient, adaptable economy in the world. And that's due to some of the many attributes that we have here that are somewhat unique. One is our system of government allows for a lot of things to happen, both with government support and with entrepreneurs using the capitalist system we have. The second area is we have the deepest and most mature capital market system, which really helps finance not only the U.S. but the world. Third, we have the strongest and best capitalized financial institutions in the world. We saw that with the stress tests that were just announced on Friday. But interestingly, in reading the annual report from J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon had one section talking about the strength of the financial institutions in which he cites that Lehman Brothers would not be allowed to collapse if they were following the current capital requirements that we have today. It's a fascinating report. If you get a chance, it's worth a read. But that really jumped out at me when I read that. Another area is that sets us apart is our currency. The strength of the economy is often reflected in its currency, and the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency. Most of the goods that trade in dollars, and the other currencies that are leading currencies, the euro and the yen, both Europe and Japan have had significant economic and structural problems in their economies. Add to that the Chinese renminbi, which they would like to be a move to reserve currency, has been somewhat, some call it managed, some call it manipulated, which makes it hard to move it into a reserve currency category. Another area that really sets the U.S. apart is our system of capitalism has fostered the creation of many of the world's most innovative and dynamic businesses. We have a culture that rewards hard work and risk-taking, and that's led to the creation of firms like Apple, Amazon, and Microsoft. And so while the role of big business is being called into question right now, and some of our companies have failed badly in their duties or just lost their way, we believe that U.S. companies, both big and small, will continue to drive our economy forward and continue to be among the world leaders. In fact, today the FT reported that a team of top UK scientists in the field of quantum computing, which is one of the next big things coming for us, have left the UK and have moved to Silicon Valley due to their access to capital and talent. That just speaks to the attractiveness of the U.S. But everything's not perfect, and we need to continue to focus on a few key areas to maintain that. And that starts with fixing our immigration policy, that the world's best and brightest come here for their education and stay and become productive contributors to the economic machine that we have here. We need to make sure that our high schools and universities remain among global leaders, and we immediately need to make significant investments in our physical, educational, and digital infrastructure to ensure that we remain the standout economy. This is one area that it's safe to say that both our political parties have failed greatly and continue to do it. This is an area that is no longer postponable, and we need to get back on track. So the answer is yes, Sean. We believe that the U.S. will remain the standout economy, but we can't be complacent. We need to set aside partisan politics and get to work.
Great. Thanks, Stephen. All right, Ross, let's bring you to the conversation here. The U.S. stock market's been on a bit of a roller coaster ride recently. Can you share with us some thoughts on whether taking a long-term view still matters for investors?
Thank you, Sean.
Yeah,
first, market timing is exceptionally hard to do. In my experience, in our experience, cumulatively, calling tops is at best a matter of random error. And while we've noticed people tend to be better at calling bottoms, it's almost always because they're selling into them as opposed to buying at them. In other words, even the talking heads you hear on CNBC and the other television networks and the like are generally pretty much wrong on the idea of market timing. We think that it's important anyone who's trying to guess the bottom or guess the top, they need to remember that, as we noted in our last outlook, 65% of all quarters through modern investing history have been positive return quarters. People tend to fixate on what can go wrong, and that's because what can go wrong is a very seductive type of argument. But if you let fear drive your investment strategy, you're going to end up with what is at best a suboptimal investment return over time. History says that much of the excess return that the equity market generates over bonds and even cash will be concentrated into a series of very short periods of time. It's not uncommon for half or more of a year's total equity market return to be generated in 10 or fewer trading days. If you miss those 10 days, you're going to find it all but impossible to keep up with the returns of the equity market over any extended period of time. Those who want you to try to time the market will therefore need to explain to themselves and to their clients how they will be able to identify in advance what those all-important 10 or fewer days are going to be. We also think that there's another factor that people need to remember about the equity market, and that's that it's not just investors who are involved. Companies are in the market buying back their own shares, and strategic and private capital buyers are looking for opportunities to grab up assets that they see as valuable at attractive prices. May was a difficult month for the equity markets, but in May we saw an example of this when the German firm Infineon stepped up and bought out what was one of our largest positions, Cypress Semiconductor. Bears were telling investors that they should avoid Cypress because it was exposed to the auto sector and the smartphone sector and the electronic device sector, all areas that were seeing slowing demand because of near-term economic concerns, and all of which were being given by the bears in the name to avoid the stock. Infineon saw a market leader that was being ignored by the market, so while those who feared the near-term business environment stayed on the sidelines, Infineon jumped in, paid a 50% premium, and moved to take control of the company. And we think this raises a very important point, or actually two very important points. One, you can never predict when something is going to happen. And two, the value of a company is far more stable and often in great contrast to the price of its stock. The only way to catch the closure of a valuation gap is to be in the name when the event that closes that gap occurs. And it's something that's very hard to do when you're focused on trying to guess where the market's going to be over the next few days, weeks, or even months.
Good point. Ross, Cypress was obviously a great outcome for clients. Could you maybe take a little time and talk about the current secular themes in the portfolio and maybe some recent activity within the portfolio?
Certainly. We believe that, and as I've mentioned this before in prior calls, that when you're buying ownership in a business, you're buying stock, you're not actually trying to outguess capital flows. You're actually trying to effectively position yourself for long-term business development. Our investment process, as you know, is driven by a focus on secular themes, where we see long-term persistence and by the fundamental outlooks of specific companies exposed to those themes. The market is a dynamic creature, and as a result, it rarely stays static for long, and it requires those of us who work in it to be open to adjusting how we operate inside it. This dynamism can offer gifts to investors both through rapid short-term moves to the upside in names that one owns and to, at times, similar sharp downside moves in names that one would like to own or add to. This year already, we've been able to take advantage of some of these sharp down moves to initiate positions in a number of attractive, high-quality positions that we were able to get into at attractive prices in areas such as defense, 5G, cybersecurity, and healthcare. Specific names we've initiated positions in include Palo Alto Networks, which is a leader in cybersecurity. We've watched the company for some time, but a rapid 20% drop in price gave us an opportunity to initiate a position in the company we really think is very attractively positioned for the long time in that exciting area. Another name we added is Boeing, which I'm sure all of you know has been mired in a crisis of its own manufacture. Boeing is one of only two players in the growing large commercial aircraft market, where we're seeing demand grow at a rate meaningfully faster than the global economy. Boeing is also the number two defense and space contractor in the United States. We firmly believe the 737 MAX will be flying again, and Boeing will return to winning its fair share of the passenger jet market. The company has stumbled with its early response to the crisis, but being half of a duopoly in an industry where backlogs stretch out to 5 years or more allows it that more than enough time to recover. And when it does, we see a company that's going to return to being the world-class company that it was before the Ethiopian crash. We've also been able to reduce or eliminate positions in names we thought were fairly valued or fully valued when they opened the year with some very strong moves to the upside. As a result of these moves and the Cypress takeover I mentioned earlier, we're carrying more cash than we would usually carry. But these volatile and uncertain times, we see that cash as offering us the ability to take advantage of rapidly developing opportunities, as I've mentioned above. We've also shifted our portfolio's technology exposure away from hardware and more towards software, cybersecurity, and 5G, which are both less cyclical and less exposed to the vagrancies of the China trade situation. And we continue to look for opportunities to put cash to work in situations where we see the wind at our back.
Okay, Ross, given the current backdrop, what should investors do now?
Well, first, and this is, I think, guidance I would offer for all environments, be patient, be disciplined, avoid watching too much investment TV because the time horizon of the people on the TV is very different than your time horizon. And we also believe that you need to focus on the long-term opportunities that we have in front of us. As I mentioned, you know, markets are dynamic and the world is also quite dynamic and it's changing all the time and that change presents opportunity. Our investment disciplines are designed to help us take the emotion out of investing because we found that emotion is an investor's worst enemy. Don't let frustration with politicians or the political environment or concern about the myriad of things that can go wrong keep you from doing what is right, which is investing your capital for the long term. In the close to 40 years I've been doing this, I found that the bear story is always going to be more seductive than the bull story because in the end, the bull story is that in the long run, things work out. And so far, they always have. And that means that if we should see a sharp pullback, that pullback will prove to be the breeding ground of future profits. If you doubt that, you don't have to look back any further until Christmas Eve. You know, things look pretty grim on Christmas. I know when I went home on Christmas Eve, I was a little bit more grinchy than I usually am on that great day. The pundits were filling the airwaves with talk about worst days ahead for the equity markets and telling us that the bull market was dead, and literally they could not have been more wrong. And those who succumbed to the righteous and quite honestly understandable fear they were peddling paid a very heavy price for listening to that advice. So I would say, as Warren Buffett sort of says, be fearful when all around you are ebullient, and be greedy when all those around you are succumbing to panic. And when you're not sure what you should be doing, don't hesitate to reach out to us, because our job is not only to invest your assets, it's to help put in context all these things that are going on around the world and how they influence and affect your portfolio and the markets in general.
Okay, a bit of a follow-on to that last question, Ross. Our portfolios and strategies have performed very strongly so far this year. What's the reason for staying invested here?
Well, first, as I mentioned earlier, our investment process is driven by secular themes. And these themes are generally in the very early stages of their life. The inexorable demographic trends are driving changes in the way medicine is going to be practiced and diseases are going to be detected and treated in the years ahead, and that's only going to grow. A few years ago, cyber threats were largely seen as people attempting to steal access companies' systems, to steal customer data, or to steal intellectual property. Today, cybersecurity is needed by businesses to help protect the corporations from nation states and actors working on their behalf who are engaged in foreign policy actions, in addition to the traditional cyber criminal. And that's only going to accelerate as we go forward. You know, the U.S. efforts to isolate and defang Huawei should have made the importance of 5G pretty apparent to anyone and everyone, and the press coverage around this issue highlights what we see as a likely development of two separate spheres of 5G development, with the West needing to be able to produce and supply our needs independent of Chinese players and technology, and the Chinese in their sphere of influence needing to be able to do the same. And then in the defense space, we spent the last 18 years fighting an asymmetrical war against Islamic fundamentalist terrorist organizations, while our major global opponents, China and Russia, spent it developing and bringing into service weapon systems that in some cases far outstrip the capabilities of our own systems to counter or defend against. And for the first time in a long time, the United States military is in a mode where they need to catch up, and they need to catch up fast, or they could have geopolitical ramifications. These trends aren't going to go away anytime soon, and the opportunities they offer are here now, and they'll continue to grow over the next 3, 4, 5 years. Additionally, as I mentioned earlier, we've built up a larger pool of cash than we would usually have, and with the exceptional volatility of markets, that encourages us to keep this cash so that we can deploy it opportunistically. And while in the short run having more cash than usual could act as a drag on performance, it also lets us be really swift to take up opportunities that the market gives us. Lastly, I think it's important to note that our portfolios offer really substantial upside per Wall Street estimates and expectations. Our all-cap strategy offers a 25% weighted upside to analysts' near-term price targets. Our more conservative core strategy offers an upside of 15% or so to those same types of targets, and our focused small cap upside is roughly 80%. We can't tell you when these valuation gaps will be closed or even if all of them will be closed, but we do know that this type of upside opportunity does warrant our continued investment in these names.
Well said, Ross. If I could just add one final thought, and that is, certain areas of the economy will attract capital regardless of the latest tweet coming out of the White House, regardless of when and how the China trade situation gets resolved, and regardless whether U.S. GDP advances at a 3% annual rate or a rate of 2%. Consider that over $800 billion is going to be spent globally on the rollout of 5G. That's $800 billion. We're pretty sure that some companies are going to benefit from that spend. Billions more will go into cloud computing and the related services around cloud. And we would argue that we're in the early innings of cloud computing. Look no further than Jamie Dimon's shareholder letter that Stephen mentioned earlier. Jamie Dimon talks about, he touches on many things. It's a fascinating letter. But one of the things he talks about is his skepticism towards cloud computing early on. He thought it was more hype than anything else. And in the letter, he points the finger at himself as being wrong and having J.P. Morgan playing a little catch-up here. They're all in. And just look at one company in J.P. Morgan. Their tech budget alone is $11.5 billion for 19, right? So Ross talked about cybersecurity. Billions are going to flow into cyber. If you own a business, you're investing in cyber, because if you're not, you're going to wake up one day and not have a business. Defense companies. We talked about the fact that there was a lack of spending over the last decade in defense, and now you're seeing a huge backlog as we get a catch-up there. There's an arms race going on for supersonic missile technology. Healthcare. Ross talked about that a little bit. I mean, demographics alone will change the force of spending. So it's important to keep in mind. And as an investment committee, it's really important for us to be cautious in uncertain times, no question. But we need to remind ourselves to be opportunistic when the market offers us a gift in a high-quality, well-managed business that's positioned to benefit from these trends. And I think the title of the call really summarizes our current mindset, and that is to be cautious, but we will not hesitate to act when the opportunities present themselves. So with that, I'm going to conclude our comments for today. On behalf of Stephen and Ross and the entire ARS family, we'd like to thank you for your business. We hope you have a fantastic summer with your family. And we look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thank you again.
That concludes our conference. Thank you for using AT&T Event Conferencing Enhanced. You may now disconnect.